And this is KPCW 806 on this Tuesday morning. It's May 6th. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Let's see. Currently, we've got 38 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Looks like those rain showers have stopped, at least for now. We've got 42 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Hayes. We had a little bit of snow falling earlier.
Yeah, I was going to say, good morning. Yeah, we've had a little bit of a taste of winter scene out there. Some mixed rain and snow showers coming down, especially as you get up towards the resort areas as well. But as we go throughout the day, we'll still keep that unsettled weather pattern around. We'll see the rain and snow showers this morning. That'll be kind of intermittent across the area, changing to more rain showers this afternoon. But still, it's going to be a cool day out there with temperatures only in the mid-50s for highs around Park City. We should climb into the low 60s there in the Heber Valley, but overall, we'll have unsettled weather conditions. Not a complete washout by any means today, but there will be off and on showers, very similar to what we saw yesterday. Now, so go into your Thursday or Wednesday, we should be looking at partly cloudy skies Wednesday, sunny skies on your Thursday, and then we start to see the pattern change developing. So we'll start off with mid-30s for your Wednesday morning. As we start to dry things out, just a slight chance of an isolated shower during the day on Wednesday. Highs will jump into the low 60s in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 70s there in the Heber Valley. And then as we get towards your Sunday, or your Sunday, your Thursday going into your Friday, that's when we'll see all that sunshine out there. Temperatures will be around 40 to start, and we'll see those highs climbing back into the upper 60s here as we go throughout the afternoon hours. In Park City, we'll see highs in the mid-70s on your Thursday in the Heber Valley there. But again, that sunshine will continue to boost those temperatures. So how about the low 70s for Park City by the end of the work week on your Friday, with highs in the upper 70s there in the Heber Valley, closing in on 80 degrees. And again, we'll stick with that sunshine right on into the weekend. High temperatures will be climbing into the mid-70s in Park City by Saturday, highs in the low 80s in the Heber Valley, and we'll see those morning lows jumping up into the low to mid-40s as well. So it's going to be pretty mild, and we'll stay pretty mild right on into your Sunday as well with partly cloudy skies. We'll see those temperatures starting off around 50 with highs in the mid-70s in Park City, with highs in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. And as we head into next week, we're going to see a trough of low pressure that's going to try to approach the area by next Monday and a Tuesday. Still a little far out for specific details, but there is the chance that that could bring us some more cooler and unsettled weather conditions back to the area, primarily as we get into your Monday night heading into Tuesday. And that means increasing chances for showers and thunderstorms potentially, and some cool air moving back in by the middle of the work week. But between now and then, once we get past today's kind of cool and unsettled weather, Leslie, we got a big warm up heading into the weekend. It's definitely going to feel and look more like springtime around here.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much.
And thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh with a preview of this week's county council meeting. From the Park City Board of Realtors, I have President Maverick Bolger along with MLS President Todd Anderson taking a look at the first quarter report, and Vice President of Communications for Summit Land Conservancy, Caitlin Willard, in discussing some open space issues. Taking a look at some local news now, the Heber City Council will consider a new system for collecting and spending certain affordable housing development fees. At its meeting tonight, KPCW's Grace Dorfler explains it's an effort to build more affordable units downtown.
State lawmakers prohibited municipalities from requiring affordable housing as part of new developments in 2022. Now, whenever Heber works on master development agreements for new homes, it must negotiate any affordable housing requirements every time. The city aims for at least 10% of new units to be affordable and deed restricted. Developers can also bypass that requirement by paying a fee in lieu, a fee in place of the affordable construction. In Park City and the Snyderville Basin, the policy is 20% affordable units. Up to now, those fees have been paid to the Wasatch County Housing Authority, but that system could soon change if the Heber City Council adopts a new ordinance at its meeting Tuesday, as City Manager Matt Brower explained on KPCW's Local News Hour Monday.
Heber City is interested in undertaking some affordable housing projects itself. So rather than obligate the money to the county's Affordable Housing Board, Heber City simply wants to maintain the option of investing some of that money in its own affordable housing projects.
Brower said the change could help ensure that affordable housing is constructed close to infrastructure and services people with lower incomes might need.
Maybe move them closer to town where there's schools, there's more shopping, more transportation options. And so we're looking at how we can move many of the obligations currently negotiated in development agreements into the downtown area where they can be better served.
The ordinance, if approved, would enable Heber to use the fees in lieu to buy land or pay for the construction of affordable units. According to a 2023 city report, in 2020, Heber was over 300 units short of the demand for affordable housing. Based on growth projections, the city estimated it would need to construct over 1,100 units by 2028 to close the gap and meet the needs of a growing population. Affordable housing is typically designated for people who earn 80% of the area median income or less. For 2025, the Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust reports that 80% threshold is around $76,000 for one person or $109,000 for a family of four in Wasatch County. The Heber City Council meeting begins at 6 p.m. Tuesday. For an agenda and a link to attend online, visit kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, I got to ask you, because we've talked about this a few times, the meeting agenda seems to go up like a minute before the deadline, 24 hours in front of the meeting. What takes so long for Wasatch County to post its council agendas? Because you had the Planning Commission agenda up, you know, Sunday.
Yeah, so the council agenda is published by our clerk auditor's office. And usually we have the materials in Thursday of the week prior to the council meetings. Sometimes they delay that implementation due to staffing constraints or if there are requests from the clerk's office to add things to the agenda after that deadline that we've kind of imposed on ourselves.
Hmm. So it's you've got to wait for it or you can't just push it back a week?
Really, we just try to work with the clerk auditor's office to make sure that all of the things that we've provided, that the agenda is ready to go. And really, it's up to them so far to publish that. So we have looked at making some changes there, but haven't made any yet.
All right. So who's posting the Planning Commission agendas?
Our planning staff actually manage that. So those fall under my purview.
All right. What's the latest with the sheriff's office investigation? As we reported, Wasatch County hired a retired judge to look into this.
Yeah, so Judge McKelvey is still going through his investigation. He dealt with a short bout of some health issues, so we had to pause the investigation for a little bit, but he's back at it right now, and we're hoping to be able to conclude that probably the next few weeks.
Okay, so will those findings be made public?
There will be a written report produced at the end of the process, and ultimately I don't know what will be included in that, but yes, we will have some outcomes from that.
Well, certainly the report's being paid for with taxpayer dollars. Is there some reason to keep it under wraps?
No, I mean, other than that there may be aspects of it that have sensitive nature that wouldn't be subject to information requests, just depending on, again, I don't know what will be in it, but it's possible that there's something in it that falls under a protected category.
Mm-hmm. Another investigation is happening, and this is being done by the Cache County, I don't know if it's the sheriff's office or the attorney's office there. Sheriff Rigby had hired them to look into that. Any idea on what's happening there?
Yeah, I believe Cache County has attempted to reach out to people to deal with some of the specific criminal accusations that were being levied. I don't know that there have been many members of the public willing to speak with them, and so I'm not exactly sure of the status of Cache County's investigation, but really we consider it parallel to Wasatch County's, which ours has a broader scope, more on administrative and civil matters.
Yeah, so are the two investigations being kept separate?
Yes, I think we have coordinated a little bit on some requests to conduct interviews, a single interview rather than two separate interviews. Other than that, they're independent.
Now, because the sheriff's office is an elected position, what say do you have as manager, or what say does the county council have in any of this?
I mean, my office and the county council have a duty to ensure that countywide policies are being followed by any elected office. And really, I think what we're doing is just making sure that any accusations that people have raised are being addressed. And we, in order to do that, we need to gather all the information, make informed decisions, and kind of just proceed from there. So there are options. It all just depends on what comes out of that investigation. But there are limitations to things we can do, given you know, Sheriff Rigby is an independently elected official, and he has powers and duties associated with that independent of ours through state code.
Yeah, now is this Deputy Fredrickson still on administrative leave?
I don't know. I haven't been directly involved in it at this time, so.
Okay. Let's see, taking a look at the agenda, you've got the health department has prepared its annual report. What does that have to say?
So every year our health department comes and kind of reports on health outcomes. Overall, Wasatch County is a very healthy county. They're also going to talk a little bit about just what all of the duties of the health department are. What are the services they provide? How many staff are there? You know, on the rest agenda are some other department presentations that will cover much of the same materials.
Okay. And again, I mean, I didn't have a chance to look at the report. So, again, when it's published so late in the day, it's just, I mean, it's like I don't have great questions for you to say, oh, well, what about this? What about that? So just one more reason that we would appreciate more than a 24-hour notice of the agenda. Again, Clerk Auditor Joey Granger also making a presentation. What's that going to be about?
So we've been doing a series of department presentations just to kind of update the council and the public about all of the departments in the county, what their duties are, what the staffing positions are, kind of any long-range issues that they see. So this is just a continuation of that. So the clerk auditor's office is presenting, given we had the other tax offices present last month, and then we have some of the administrative offices also presenting this week.
Okay, and any idea what the human resources director, David Rowley, will have to say?
Yeah, just those same things explain to the public what the size of his staff are, what the duties that he deals with, kind of just a high-level overview of his department.
Okay, is this what happens, something like this every year? Is that what you try to hear from?
Yeah, so what we've been trying to do is every 2 years when we have new council members, we have Colleen Bonner who's joined the council, and it's a good refresher for the other council members as well as the members of the public, just to kind of to survey. Wasatch County is a, you know, not a small organization anymore, and many of the departments have a wide variety of issues. Even ones that you might think are pretty straightforward actually deal with a lot of complex issues, and I think it's a useful way of explaining what the value the public gets out of their tax dollars.
All right. Let's see, the council will also hear from County Attorney Scott Sweat talking about Ordinance 2506. This deals with the disposition of the indigent dead. So what's the ordinance providing for?
So under state code, counties are required to cover costs of burial services for people who don't have any funds that would to otherwise cover it. Now in state code, it's clear that the primary responsibility lies with the individual and their immediate family, and there's kind of a line of responsibility there, and that the county is at the end of that process. What we've seen is recently, with the opening of some of the new care facilities, there has been an increased demand on these services. And so what we're trying to do is actually mimic what some other counties do with this process, and that more having a more formal application and more clear guidelines of what is required, what type of information is necessary for us to be able to award these funds, just so that we are being responsible with taxpayer dollars and not unnecessarily subsidizing some of these costs that might otherwise be somebody else's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And so this is with folks who indigent but have no other family members that are stepping up?
Yeah, and that generally that's how it works, is if an individual doesn't have sufficient funds in any kind of accounts that they own, that their immediate next of kin are responsible for it. But there are instances where someone doesn't have any next of kin, or no one is able to identify their next of kin, and ultimately that becomes the county's responsibility. So we're looking at publishing an RFP to identify a funeral home service that would kind of set a price of what we would be able to reimburse from Wasatch County on, and then again, that application process so that people know what information is required, or the funeral homes to say what is the reasonable level of due diligence to assure that there isn't a next of kin that is responsible for these expenses.
Yeah, so what does happen to the body? I mean, is that what you do? Somebody comes in and takes the body and cremates it, and then what happens?
Yeah, my understanding is standard practice for these funeral homes for indigent dead is to cremate the remains. I honestly don't know what they do with it after that point.
All right, let's see. You've got a proposed MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding between Wasatch County and Heber City on annexation issues to be discussed. I heard from City Manager Matt Brower that after Heber considers the Red Rock annexation, that there would only be small infill pieces that might be annexed long-term. So is this what that MOU is about?
Yeah, actually, Heber City already adopted this MOU. We've been having some discussions over the last few months about the property out east of Heber City. This is related to the State Institutional Land Trust, SITLA, and some adjacent properties to Heber City. If you recall, Heber City had someone apply, these property owners apply for potential changes to the annexation plan. Heber City denied it. And this MOU is just an agreement between Heber City and Wasatch County that this particular property will continue to work with Wasatch County under our land use.
Okay. And then a joint meeting with the Planning Commission to review some land use rules and the potential adoption of vision statements for the general plan amendments. What are the vision statements? I mean, are they just different neighborhoods, or what are they?
Yeah, so the general plan has certain categories of emphasis that are, some are required by state code, that kind of outline what the different aspects of a general plan has to cover. So when we did our retreat earlier this year, what we ended up doing was having the council want to schedule this meeting so that we could talk through these things and really provide some high level input on the general plan update process. So what these vision statements are is kind of some guiding direction for the committees that we will use to fill out the updated general plan process. So those categories include things like land use, moderate income housing, public services, economic development, and open space and recreation.
Okay, and where are you with that general plan update? Something you expect to get approved this year?
I think we think it will take through this next year. We have concluded a recent survey that we've had, I want to say somewhere in the range of 400 responses to, providing some high-level feedback. We did one public meeting kind of with the intent of educating the public about what is a general plan and why is it important. What our next phase is going to be is actually creating committees, including planning commissioners and members of the public in each of these areas, to be able to dive in more detail. So that's where this meeting comes in, is setting the vision for each of these categories, helps provide that guidance so that the county council can say, hey, this is what we want out of these things. And so when they get into the meat of actually writing out and updating the general plan, they can use this as that kind of high level instruction.
Okay. Hey, I gotta ask you, because I was really surprised when I saw it. I made a trip to Wasatch County yesterday, and as part of what I believe is the East Village development, there is a building that looks like it is toppling over US 40, a three-story building or something. It's just really right on the edge of the freeway. What's that building for?
I think you might be referring to the new Hilton Canopy. There is a hotel adjacent to the Deercrest Gondola. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So it's a hotel that was approved a few years ago. It's under construction now, and it's in a piece adjacent to the newly aligned frontage road that connects the north portal. So this is right across from the Deercrest Gondola that would connect down into the Mayflower Interchange.
All right, so I'm guessing there is some setback, but it sure doesn't look like it from US 40, again, going 70 miles an hour either.
Yeah, actually, there's US 40, then there's a frontage road, then there's the hotel, so.
Okay. All right, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, not this morning.
Okay, Dustin, thanks for your time.
See ya.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Well, the Park City Real Estate Officials say that the real estate market continues to experience steady growth and stable inventory for the first quarter of 2025. In the studio with details, I have the president of the board, Maverick Bolger, along with the president of the Park City Multiple Listing Service, Todd Anderson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the report says inventory is stable, but it seems like there hasn't been enough inventory for 4 years. So is that what that is saying, that it's just the same old thing, not a lot of inventory, or are you actually seeing some new inventory? Todd?
You know, I think as we look at it, we're getting used to the idea that inventory isn't there. We're still at a spot where we're 20 to 30% below pre-COVID inventory levels, but they seem to be stabilizing at that number. So maybe we're looking at what our new normal is.
Yeah, so it seems like there's a lot of construction happening, especially in the Wasatch County area. So what's happening with those units?
They're being absorbed pretty quickly at this point, and I think you'll see some of the builders maybe back off a little on some of it as it, those pieces that don't get absorbed, they'll slow down that process. While there's a lot being built and a lot on the books, it could take a while to get it all done.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, Leslie, it's important to recognize just how different our median income is versus the rest of the state. So you see pieces of legislation, targeting first-time home buyers and acquisition of initial properties, and we just are so far above what you can acquire property for on the Wasatch front that it's more about product type in the Wasatch back. So we're hoping to see more nightly rentable product in Midway as the homestead expansion goes on and things like that, mix things up a little bit. But as far as the single family townhome type product goes, we've got quite a lot of that in Wasatch County, as you noted.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the sales of single family homes for the first quarter of 2025. I guess just based upon a year ago, that's how you kind of compare these numbers?
Yeah, we have to go year to year. Otherwise, we just don't have a large enough sample size and things get really skewed if you start to look at just a quarter versus quarter kind of attitude on it. So we've got spots where we'll look back a year, but we really try and use a rolling average over the past 12 months to really get an idea of what's happening.
So what can you tell us about single family homes based on this quarter versus a year ago?
Fairly steady, really. We've got some steadiness to it. We can look at pockets and say, there are pockets where we can look and say, okay, we're up 20% in the actual number of sales while pricing has been relatively flat. So not seeing a huge increase in the pricing, but still seeing the sales happen quickly.
Yeah, especially by product type, where we've got the done, ready to go, remodeled stuff. We mentioned the last time we were on the radio, it was a tale of two markets where the things with the premium attached to them are going quickly, and the stuff that needs work tends to be sitting a little bit longer.
Yeah, except for that home and Park Meadows, I noticed there at the corner of Lucky John and Little Kate. I mean, it's an acre of land and Holiday Village Ranches. I mean, it's probably an acre of property. My guess, what, a $4 million, $5 million home just brought to the ground?
Yeah, with the fires that that you're talking about there, Leslie, or
was that where the fire was?
Yeah. So they were pretty far along with their project and unfortunately lost it.
Okay.
Yeah, so not something that anybody likes to see, but I'm sure will regrow as it gets in, but it's that was something that was very unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we used to see quite a bit of that, though. I mean, it wasn't due to a fire; it was just due, this is where I want to live, and I have enough money. I mean, are we seeing those as much as prices climb?
I think we'll see a little pushback on some of that as we try and figure out what building costs are going to be. I think there's a big question mark out there right now. I'm sure you've talked to other people that are saying, hey, we're putting projects on hold till we figure out what costs are going to be. But in general, I think you're correct. I mean, we don't have a lot of land to build on, and so the options are you buy something and, you're buying it for the land value.
All right. So the board had listed, or at least the report had listed, a number of concerns about how the housing market will be affected into the future. Do we know how tariffs will hit housing?
It's a lot of question marks.
If we had a crystal ball, right? I think everyone is saying, hey, you know, we've seen a mercurial effect in federal policy where, you know, one week the story is A and the next week the story is B. We're kind of in the battlegrounds now where if we're not backing off quickly on certain tariff groups, we're going to see compounded effects. And it may be too late in certain, you know, micro markets, at least for a little blip of impact where, you know, LA ports are not busy right now and week over week they're shrinking in terms of ship traffic. That will be felt, I think, by the consumer, you know, public and you know, folks that need stuff that's coming off of those boats.
All right, I thought you're going to quip off the quote that I saw from the report, quote, national economic policy seemed to be playing darts in the dark, creating more confusion than clarity.
A little bit,
great,
yes.
Great line. Yeah, okay. Can home sales hold up, though, as prices get more expensive? Because people are probably going to get less, right?
I think we're definitely seeing some of that. And I think, as you look at the separations within our market, as you move toward the Wasatch County product that's being built, it's much less expensive than the Park City product. And as we see the shift in Deer Valley, where you were just talking about a new hotel going in over there, and see that shift around the corner, I think you'll see people that'll have that ability to move and have things make sense. And I think with those different product types are going to allow people to still buy homes.
I don't know if you caught the U.S. Newsweek headline this week, Leslie, but we once again claimed the top spot for Utah being the number one state in the country across, you know, 5 to 10 categories from, you know, healthcare and education to housing and crime. And, I think we are the creme de la creme for a lot of people, you know. So as we might see a little bit of urban flight as, big downtown areas falter a little bit with tariff policy, it's not unexpected for us to see a big drove of especially higher income buyers heading to Park City and the surrounding areas.
Okay, so you said that was the U.S. News and World Report?
Yeah, U.S. Newsweek, yep.
Okay. And what about mortgage rates? Where are we standing there?
Fairly unpalatable to the broad buying public still. What we are seeing is some builders offering incentives that will undercut market rate on those, and they're subsidizing that rate in-house by controlling their process from, you know, beginning to end with having a loan brokerage, you know, within their development company. So that is offering folks an ability to get in at under a 5% rate in some cases. Out towards the Jordanelle, we've seen that advertised lately, and so that is an interesting option, and I think it has been driving sales for those particular developments.
Yeah, just the one-off though. I mean, what would somebody, what's 30 rate?
You're in the mid to high sixes. You're 6.75 to 7, depending on what your individual situation is.
Yeah, which isn't terrible. I mean, right? It's not back like the 80s where we saw it at 18%, right?
Yeah, I think when you stack that with purchasing power as compared with earning, in salary, that's where people are having a hard time, right? It's not an 18% mortgage where you're in, pretty close parity with the price of your home on an annual salary basis. It's a much more expensive product from the start.
Yeah, so can you kind of give us an idea of some of the median prices that were looking at around the area, with single family homes? Where are we at there?
We're still getting to a spot where, as we look at the whole area, your median single family is pressing $2 million in a lot of spots. So our market has changed and isn't, it doesn't bode well for the entry level buyer. But that's kind of always been the case in our marketplace. I think we have a little less of a hard line on where this area starts and other areas begin as we've grown outside of our boundaries on what was just an easy to say, Park City is this and everything else is 20 miles away. We've gotten a lot closer.
Yeah, I mean, with the Deer Valley East Village pricing, at Four Seasons in particular, creeping close to $5,000 a square foot for some of those completions in 2028. That, you know, like Todd said, that line between Park City and Summit County, Wasatch County, has disappeared a little bit as we're, you know, creeping to the south.
$5,000 a square foot?
Very nearly.
Holy cow, what do you get for that?
A lot of fancy stuff, I'm guessing.
What's normal? I mean, just in a...
Yeah, for a very nicely appointed custom build, most people are hovering around $1,000 a square foot. So, you know, that can creep up towards $2,000 if you get really niche with some of your finishes. But that would be a very, very nice home by most people's standards.
Okay. And what's the most popular product then? These condos, these townhomes there that are nightly rentals as opposed to, you know, just year-round single-family condominiums?
You know, I think we spread across all marketplaces in that respect. And I think, you know, as you look into that northern end of Heber, most of that that's being built does not allow nightly rentals. So it's kind of a surprise for a lot of people. And then you can look and say, yes, I could buy a brand new single family home for under $1 million. It's not going to be a huge expanse, but you can get into things that have that capability. You know, so there is a broad marketplace, and I think we're hitting a lot of different opportunities for people.
Yeah. So what are some of the hot spots? It seems like Promontory was there for several quarters.
Promontory still, you know, kind of is about 10% of our marketplace. So they are, you know, still building out there, still have things going on, and are still, you know, a major, you know, impact in what our market looks like.
Yeah, and we're still seeing a fair amount of movement in the ultra wealth segment, where folks are a little bit less tied to the ebbs and flows of economic policy day to day, maybe a little bit more shored up in their cash reserves. So you know, homes that are north of $5 million and especially north of $10 million, you know, the prevailing loan rate on any given day doesn't seem to have much impact on those transactions. We actually this week just had the second highest closing in the history of Utah occur. So, I mean, you know, we're definitely seeing that part of the market moving freely. And then I think to Todd's you know, earlier point, people want nightly rental. They're not necessarily getting it everywhere. They like the flexibility, or the idea at least, of being able to rent long term and short term. We are seeing, though, you know, a lot of the folks that invested in short term over the COVID years now finding that long term's a little bit easier. You know, they don't have to manage as much. You know, they're not having to struggle to meet their, you know, average nightly rental rates, and you know, some of the short term managers that we've been talking to lately have felt that, you know, as their business might have contracted a little bit.
All right, tell me about that second highest closing. Where is that?
It actually hasn't crossed the MLS yet, but I know of it, and it'll be in one of our coveted gated ski communities here in the hills.
Okay, well, what are we talking about? What's something like that cost?
You know, we're up in the 20s, 30s, 40s of millions of dollars, so, you know, big numbers here.
Yeah, what was the number one largest?
That was the one that closed recently in Deer Crest, I think that was a $52 million number, if I'm recalling correctly,
It came across as an undisclosed sales price. I believe it had a $65 million asking price on it.
So that's in the ballpark. So that's probably well above the $5,000 square foot.
Yeah, I mean, but some of these houses are 10, 20, 30,000 square feet when you, you know, add all the livable up. So, it, you know, it's maybe not as dramatic as some of the prices that we're seeing at East Village.
Okay. Any other reflections on this first quarter numbers?
You know, I think we're feeling a warming effect, you know, just anecdotally, you know, buyers are kind of, you know, I don't know that we have as much stability as we were hoping for at this time in the year, but a little bit less frenetic than during the election period and the first couple months of the new administration. So, you know, we're seeing segments that were pretty icy over the winter, you know, coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, and Todd?
Yeah, and I think we're going to see some inventory. We see pockets of spots that have higher inventory levels, and we'll see things move around. And I think, you know, we're going to get people ready to buy at this point. And I think they get, there's a fatigue that sets in that says, okay, this is what it's going to be. The inventory's not going to come up. The interest rates aren't necessarily going to change a whole lot. And I still want a home.
Yeah, and isn't quarter one usually the busiest or the biggest numbers? No,
actually quarter one is generally our lowest number. So, you know, fourth quarter, first quarter is the slowest, fourth quarter is the second slowest. It's the, you know, spring and fall spring, summer, fall is actually when the most of the inventory moves.
Ah, okay. People have an opportunity. They come out kind of in the winter, and then they come out again in the spring.
Absolutely.
If they have time to make that offer. Yeah. Right?
And those same people that want to buy something for the winter will be looking in the fall to say, okay, I want to buy this now and have this ready to come in for the winter. So this is coming into our busy time in terms of the real estate market.
Okay. Todd Anderson and Maverick Bolger, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
In the studio now with an update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have the Vice President of Communications, Caitlin Willard. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. So you're filling in for CEO Cheryl Fox, who is in the nation's capital doing what?
Cheryl Fox is in Washington, D.C. for the Land Trust Alliance's Advocacy Days Conference, and that happens every year, and she always goes. The Advocacy Days gives land trust leaders from across the country the opportunity to participate in meetings with members of Congress and their key agency staff. It also gives us the opportunity to educate the newly seated Congress about our work in Utah's communities and advocate for important policies and federal funding that the land trust community really depends on, like the Farm Bill.
Yeah, we have heard lots of money coming from that Farm Bill. We also keep hearing about how funds are being frozen or withdrawn. So does the Conservancy really know how many of its grants could be threatened?
I think right now we're kind of just waiting to see what happens. A lot of the funding that we get to do our work is federal funding, so we're just kind of hanging around and waiting to see what happens.
Okay. Any reports from Cheryl in terms of
She just landed yesterday, so I'm sure she's meeting with somebody important right now. And if you check out our social media, I'm sure I'll have some cool pictures of her with some powerful people talking about land conservation in the next week.
Okay. Let's see. April 30th, Summit Land Conservancy and Park City Municipal held a ribbon-cutting event to finally celebrate saving Treasure Hill. You got a good turnout for it?
We finally did it, yes. There was a great turnout. We partnered with Park City Municipal, and it was just an amazing community gathering of people. There were all the members of THINK, which was that group that was really strongly opposing the development back in the day, before we even passed the bond. We had current and past elected city officials showing up to that. We had nonprofit leaders that were involved in advocating for that open space bond that we passed. We had someone who actually read a poem about Treasure Hill, and there were genuine happy tears shed at this event because I think people are just so thrilled to know that this iconic hillside above Old Town is going to stay the way it is. Cheryl and Mayor Worrell both spoke, and then there were some cookies and hot cocoa because you need that kind of stuff at a ribbon cutting. The energy at the event was really uplifting and hopeful, and you know, this conservation project has been a long time coming, and we've finally done it. We've put a permanent conservation easement on 105 acres right there. I mean, we're looking at it right now, and it's amazing that it's going to stay that way forever.
Yeah. And earlier in the month, you hosted a Stewardship Saturday at the Marchant Meadows Preserve. What happened then?
Okay, so our stewardship team is trying to do some more kind of hands-on-the-land experiences, and so we had a volunteer event out at Marchant Meadows Preserve, which is in Paoa, and we did a bunch of cottonwood and willow plantings to really establish the bank of the river out there. And we had a really great turnout, so we're just rolling with it. We're doing more Stewardship Saturdays. We had one this past Saturday, May 3rd, at the Nuzzles & Co. Rescue Ranch, because we have a preserve out there. It's called Nanabees Preserve. And basically, we had a great turnout at that, too. Everyone was super fun and kind and willing to work and eager to help, and so we worked super quickly. We removed an entire 1,000-foot barbed wire fence, which doesn't sound fun, but I guess they really did have a lot of fun out there. They ripped out some fence posts that were affecting the view shed, and they moved a pile of rocks to help beautify the existing walking trail out there. There's about a mile plus of hiking trail on that property that the Nuzzles Ranch uses to walk the dogs. And actually, there's public access, so if people want to go check it out, it sounds like it's been beautified and looks great at this point. We partnered with Sageland and Nuzzles at this event, Sageland Collaborative, and it was just really amazing to make connections with these other organizations, and we really want to do something like this again. We're also going to do more throughout the summer, a more kind of consistent schedule of these stewardship events. events, and we're going to call them Tune Up Tuesdays, which we think is kind of funny. And we will do those. I believe they'll be in the evening. So if you're into restoration work, you'll just want to probably join our mailing list, and you can find out more about these opportunities as they pop up.
Okay. That's just to check for the emails then, right?
Yep. You just go to our website and click join the mailing list.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the trees that you planted, though, there at March and Meadows. I mean, the willow and the cottonwood trees, those are natural? I mean, native vegetation?
Yep, they're native vegetation.
Because they love water, I guess is what I'm saying. So if you want to preserve water, why wouldn't you put more of a drought resistant?
Well, you want trees that are going to grow, that are sturdy, right? So you can go out there and you can clip kind of these, we call them like poles, you know, off the willow trees. And then if you just stamp them in the ground, you have like this kind of heavy metal thing that you shove in the ground and you just stick that stick in the ground, it's eventually going to grow into a tree. And then they grow really thick. So the good thing about that is it prevents erosion on those riverbanks. And that, I don't know if you've been out to the river recently, but you know, you can either put these huge, ugly, man-made looking rocks along the bank, or you can go the natural route and do the trees. And cottonwoods are really great too. They're one of the fastest growing trees out there. I think they grow like 6 feet per year. I mean, the new ones won't do that, but if you go down to a cottonwood grove and think about how quickly those trees have grown and how old they are, it's great. They're the best ones. You don't want to do a drought resistant tree or they're not going to survive.
Okay. Let's see. You also were with the Wasatch Trails Foundation at the UVU Wasatch campus just this last weekend.
Yeah. So we are kind of moving into Wasatch County to do more work. And the best thing for us to do is really partner with like-minded organizations who are already established out there. And last year, we partnered with Wasatch Trails Foundation for their Dig Day. And then on this past Saturday, we joined them at the UVU Wasatch campus to do this International Mountain Bike Day, or it's a Women's Mountain Bike Day. And there were over 100 women that showed up. So we had some really great positive conversations with these ladies, you know, really kind of reinforcing the fact that trails and land go hand in hand. You know, you can't have trails on pavement, so you got to save the land first.
Okay, and just for those questioning why there is a Women's International Mountain Bike Day, I heard from a male mountain bike coach that every day is Men's Mountain Bike Day. So just so we know, that's how it works. You've got the conservation breakfast coming up later this month, but you are sold out.
We're sold out. We sold out so quickly. That's on Wednesday, May 14th. We are going to be welcoming the Great Salt Lake Commissioner Brian Steed as our guest speaker, and he's going to be talking about agriculture along our rivers and in our watersheds and how that affects the Great Salt Lake, but in a positive way. And so the event did sell out, but if you want to join the wait list, you can just visit the website, and then we'll take your name and we'll try to get you a seat at the table. And there's just really great food and really good bacon. That's what we always look forward to.
Okay, so what have you got coming up?
June's around the corner, even though it doesn't look like it because it's snowing outside right now, but that's when the real fun begins at Summit Land Conservancy, and that's when all our programs kind of really ramp up. So we are going to be doing our Hops Hunters hikes again. We're going to be doing our nature bathing hikes, but we're going to be calling those Therapeutic Thursdays because we like alliteration where we come from. And then we'll have our Moonshine Adventures. So this is going to be our 11th year. Well, technically, I think it's our 12th year running the Hops Hunters program, but it'll be our 11th year doing the Hoppy Hour celebration in the fall. And Hops hikes are one of our most popular educational programs that we offer. The hikes always fill up. We kind of have a little bit of a following for that program. And because the hikes are so informative and interactive, we limit those to 20 people because we are doing a lot of talking out there. We're teaching about the flora and the fauna and the history of the land. And we want people to have a great experience. We don't want people straining to hear. And then our first hike is taking place on June 11th at 6 p.m. at the Virginia Mining Claims property. And that is kind of located just up behind us here in Old Town. It's kind of a fun historical property with parts of the Ontario mine system. And then there are just a ton of hops up there. Our second hike is going to take place on June 25th at the McPullen Farmlands. And that's the same time. And we will want you to go to wesaveland.org/hops hunters to sign up for these hikes, so that way you can get in there.
Yeah. So what did it, was it the miners that planted all of these hops?
Well, we like to think that it was the German miners that came to town to work, and, you know, they didn't want to give up their libations, so they were planting these hops outside their buildings. And I guess, you know, there was a red light district up near Deer Valley, and so there's a lot up in there, and, you know, women and beer go hand in hand sometimes too, I guess. So but yeah, there's just like, if you, once you've noticed a wild hop plant, you're never not going to see it. It is everywhere. I mean, when you're walking up the sidewalks in these neighborhoods in Old Town, Park City, you see hops everywhere. So it's not just in these like open spaces. You'll see them everywhere.
Okay. And finally, I just wanted to mention that we've got tomorrow, the Mountain Trails Foundation is hosting their Trails Mixer. And as you mentioned, open space and trails go hand in hand.
That's right, trails and land. So we are going to be there. I think there's 17 organizations that will be at this event tomorrow night at the Legacy Lodge. It runs from 5 till 8 p.m. I believe there's a cash bar. And we're going to have some staff there. They can answer all your open space questions and, you know, talk to you more about these programs that I've been talking about today. And you can really just stack your calendar and figure out what you want to do throughout the summer.
Okay. Caitlin, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it. I mean, we have a lot going on. I mean, these are just a few things that we have going on in the next couple of months. So I recommend, if you want to know more about what we're doing, to join the mailing list, follow us on social media, and you'll see all the other opportunities that you can get involved in.
Okay. Caitlin Willard, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Summit County deputies are asking for residents' help identifying suspects in similar burglaries at the Jeremy store. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the latest smash and grab happened early Sunday morning.
The Summit County Sheriff's Office responded to burglary alarms at the I-80 convenience store before dawn May 4th. Deputies say the store was closed when the front door was shattered. No one was in the area when they arrived. Summit County Sheriff's spokesperson Skylar Talbot.
They did get some video surveillance from the store owner that showed an individual was inside of the business and took multiple items from inside the store, stole multiple items, and then left the area.
Deputies say it resembles another early morning burglary from February 18th. That was when a suspect, also wearing a dark hoodie and blue jeans, broke a window at the Jeremy store and stole Marlboro cigarettes. Talbot says deputies seized Marlboro cigarettes from the scene as evidence in the May 4th break-in as well.
We don't typically see individuals out on foot in that area at that time. So, you know, if you are seeing something or you review some doorbell footage and see, you know, an individual out at those hours, if it's standing out to you, we'd ask that you call us and let us know.
Deputies are searching for suspects in both burglaries. Talbot says they're investigating if the break-ins are connected. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.